Good afternoon and welcome everyone to the Bus and Rail Subcommittee meeting today on Monday, December 11th, 2023. To begin with, please note that this meeting is being recorded. As usual, the meeting audio will be placed on our website, which is wmata.com. I would share a few helpful tips. For people who are joining through phone calls, you can press star 6 to mute or unmute yourself. If you would like to make comments, you can virtually raise and lower hands by pressing star 9. Everyone who is on the video conference, you can click on the mute on the speaker icon to mute or unmute yourself. And if you click on the raise hand icon, that will raise and or lower your virtual hands. If you're able to use these tools, it will be helpful because it indicates us that somebody's trying to make a comment and we can have one speaker at a time. As you join, everyone would be on mute. So I would request for everyone to please stay on mute unless speaking. It helps us eliminate any external noise. So in advance, thank you. We do have ASL sign language interpreters with us on this call. I would request everyone to please state your name when you speak and then your comments. It helps the interpreters in doing their job. It also helps everyone who is on the phone call knowing who the speaker is, as well as anybody who listens to the audio afterwards. We also request speakers to please describe themselves when initially speaking. For instance, I'm a female, Asian Indian. I have long dark hair and I wear reading glasses as well. At this time, Chair Kalibia, if you concur, I can go ahead and read the meeting agenda and then I can go through the roll call of the committee members.
Yes, please do, Anu.
Great, thank you. And while I read the agenda, I would also share my screen. So if you would give me a quick moment while I share my screen. And if somebody could confirm for me if my screen is visible.
It is.
Thank you. So as soon as I finish reading the agenda, we will go through the roll call of the committee members. At 4:05, Chair Kalabia and the committee will go through the review and approval of today's meeting agenda and last month's meeting minutes. At 4:10, we will have the topic for public right-of-way access guidelines, and we do have Scott Windley from Access Board with us. At 4:45, Dr. Maggie Butler will discuss low floor, heavy duty transit hybrid electric bus solicitation. At 5:15, we have the next topic. USDOT seeks public input on improving accessibility of transit facilities for people with disabilities. Afterwards, we will take public comments and the meeting is scheduled to adjourn at 6 p.m. Now I will stop sharing my screen. I also want to just ask any our presenters today that if you're using any visual presentation, then please describe it in detail for the convenience of our members and or members of the public who are blind or have low vision. So thank you. For public comments, I can make my announcement at that point when we reach there. Chair Kalabia, I will be going through the roll call at this time, and I would ask for any and all members who are connected to please confirm your presence when I call out your name. Azhar Atura. Darnese Bush.
Present, African American, Black woman, middle aged, wearing a multicolored beanie and a black jacket. Good evening, everybody.
Thank you, Darnese. Tino Kalabia.
Present, Filipino American with glasses, age 88, and I feel it. Thank you.
Thank you, Tino. Vanessa Coles.
Present, African American, middle age, and I'm wearing, well, my hair is in twists, individual twists, and I'm wearing a t-shirt today.
Thank you, Vanessa. Rico Dancy. Tawan Farmer.
Rico says I'm here.
Okay, thank you. Debbie
One.
Fisher. Marcy Goldstein.
We'll try to meet in person to do that.
Okay.
Okay. So, had anyone looked for Queens? Anybody looking for the federal government?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. I would request everyone to please stay on mute unless speaking. Thank you. Timothy Howard. Steve Caffin. Steve had informed that he may not be able to join the meeting today. Thomas Mangrum. Thomas had also informed that he will not be able to join the meeting today. Philippa Mazzell.
Present African American woman wearing a full length mink coat.
Thank you.
Okay, it's cotton.
Thank you. Sandy Newsel.
Present senior Caucasian female with short whitish gray hair wearing a gray turtleneck.
Thank you, Sandy. Phil Posner. Doris Ray. Denise Rush. Paul Semelford. Patrick Sheehan. Kelly Simono. Philip Weintraub. Okay, I just want to state for the record, Ms. Rush had also informed that she may not be able to join the meeting today. Chair Kalabi, that concludes the roster for today. I would ask for you to move the meeting forward at this time. You have the floor. Do you know, I would need, you would need to unmute yourself.
We need to go over what the agenda is and approve the agenda or not approve it.
Are you asking for a motion?
Last time when we saw you at noon, there were so many neighbors standing out there, as you mentioned, who were completely out of sorts.
I move that we accept the agenda as read. Darnese.
This is
A second on approving the agenda, please.
This is Sandy. I second it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Hearing no objections, the agenda is approved. The prior minutes, which I abbreviated at the last meeting, it involved the discussion of public right-of-way access guidelines, which we will be doing actually today. Al Himes discussed the WMATA bus stops, and we had a discussion of the closures of the red line, some of the red line stations. There was also a public comment period, and there was no outsiders who needed to be recorded. Approval of the minutes, a motion to approve.
Vanessa, I approve that the minutes be approved as read.
A second?
Second, Darnese.
All in favor of approving?
Aye.
Aye.
Hearing no objections, the minutes are approved. And we're now going into today's agenda, and we start with Scott Windley of the Access Board. Scott, do you want to start, please?
Sure, thank you. I'm happy to be here today. We're going to talk about public right-of-way guidelines. I'll try to go quickly through my presentation as much as I can so that we can have some time to have some questions. Let me just get set up to share here. Someone can verify for me that you're seeing my screen.
Yes, it's on.
Thank you. So we published the final rule for the public right-of-way guidelines in August of this year. Just so you guys know, they will not be enforceable until the Department of Justice and the Department of Transportation go through their rulemaking process. Don't blame the bringer of the news, but it's just the way the ADA is set up, is that there's a two-step rulemaking process that we set the guidelines, and then Department of Justice and Department of Transportation set the standards that are based on our guidelines. So that's the way it works, and so we have to wait for them to do that for it to be fully enforceable. So right now it's just really, really, really good guidance and probably something that should be followed. Okay, so if we move on to the next slide, I'm finding my bearings here. Bear with me for a second. Okay, I got it. Okay, so what's addressed in the public right-of-way guidelines? We talk about a pedestrian access route. We talk about curb ramps and blended transitions, which are which I'll try to describe to you as best I can when we get to those. Pedestrian signal heads, pedestrian activated devices, parking, on-street parking specifically, passenger loading zones, if they're provided, transit stops and transit shelters, pedestrian signs and street furniture, and all this stuff is when provided. None of it's you know, I'll get into it a little bit more, but basically all of these requirements are based on if it's provided. If there's no parking provided, there's not a requirement for parking. It's just a requirement for it to be accessible if provided. So we'll start with the purpose and application. The purpose of the rule is to provide scoping and technical requirements to ensure the pedestrian facilities located in the public right-of-way are readily accessible to and usable by pedestrians with disabilities. Both the ADA and the ABA covered facilities, so it's both for state and local governments, for places of public accommodation if they have a right-of-way, and also federal facilities as well. So it's both the ADA and ABA. Existing pedestrian facilities that are altered, if then they would need to meet the requirements. Of course, alterations is to the maximum extent feasible. Both temporary and permanent pedestrian facilities in the public right-of-way are required to comply with these requirements. So the characteristics of a pedestrian accessible route are a continuous clear width, have a passing space. If you've only provided the minimum clear width, we require a passing space every 200 feet. We talk about the slope of the, or the grade of the pedestrian access route. We talk about the cross slope. That's the slope going opposite the direction of the running slope. And we also talk about surfaces, stable, firm, and slip resistance, which you if you have any, I'm sure all of you have some knowledge of the ADA requirements. These stable, firm, and slip resistance should be fairly familiar to you. Continuous clear width, the minimum width of an pedestrian accessible route, which is a little different than a regular accessible route inside of a building. that is required to be 48 inches exclusive of the width of any curb. So that's the minimum width. Now, in most urban settings, you're going to get much wider sidewalk than a 4 foot wide sidewalk, but the minimum is 4 feet. If you provide a shared use path, that's where you have both bikes and pedestrians on the path. That's going to be the full width of the shared use path. And this graphic shows you a sidewalk that has building elements pretty much coming up to the edge of it, as well as some different surface material. And then what we're requiring is that 4 feet of the sidewalk, which is much wider than the sidewalk that's shown, the sidewalk is wider than what we require, but 4 feet of it is going to need to meet the requirements. So maybe not the whole thing meets the requirements, especially in an alteration, and maybe just 4 feet of the sidewalk. Although in most new construction, what's typically done is the full width of the sidewalk is made to meet the requirements, but it is a 4 foot minimum. But with shared use paths, it's a different requirement. The shared use paths must be accessible for the full width.
Can I ask a question, Scott?
Yes, you can.
The picture shows 4 feet minimum. And does that mean 4 feet between the edge of that mailbox and the other part of the sidewalk? Or does 4 feet include the standing mailbox?
No, the 4 foot doesn't include the standing mailbox. This is just an example of how we're only counting the 4 feet of the sidewalk, and that has to be clear. While the sidewalk width may be wider than that and have other things that are in what we call the furniture zone, which is the zone near the curb, at least a 4 foot minimum path has to be clear of those types of things.
You mentioned bikes.
I'm sorry?
You mentioned bicycle riders. They can be
With a shared use path, which is like what you see maybe out in the suburbs, maybe somewhat here in the urban settings in DC, is where both bicyclists and pedestrians are permitted on the surface, not a regular sidewalk. A regular sidewalk, bike is not supposed to be on it. Okay. But a shared use path, we require the full width of the shared use path to meet the requirements, not just 4 feet. And the reason for that is because a shared use path is usually much wider than 4 feet. And we don't want them to limit it we don't want to limit the accessible portion to only 4 feet when a shared use path can be, 10 or 12 feet wide. So.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. That's not a problem. And then width within, like if you have a median or pedestrian refuge island, when you're crossing the street and you may have a median or a pedestrian refuge island, that island is required to have a 60 inch minimum width through it. And that is so that two wheelchairs can pass through the median without having to wait in the crosswalk for someone to go through the median before they can go through the median. Obstructions like bollards and things like that you might see, especially in DC, at federal buildings, they cannot obstruct or reduce the clear width to less than 48 inches for the sidewalk. Sorry. So if you do only provide the minimum width, we require a passing space to be provided every 200 feet of length of sidewalk. So in this example that I show on the right, it's showing a sidewalk in a suburban area that is curb attached, and it happens to only be 4 feet wide. And it's a quite a long sidewalk. And so at a point, it has a wider section that is 60 inches wide. Sorry, a little indigestion. 60 inches wide and 60 inches long that provides the ability to provide a passing space. Now, typically, your sidewalk is going to be wider than that. I know in a lot of jurisdictions, the sidewalk is actually required to be wider than our minimum. So it's only an issue when you get into those suburban areas where they try to minimize the size of the sidewalk. And so if you do have that condition, that passing space has to happen every 200 linear feet of sidewalk. Now, the maximum pedestrian access route grade, that's the running slope, okay, is 5% or 1 in 20. And this is showing, in this graphic, I'm showing you a pretty steep sidewalk. And I'm going to get to that because, as we all know, in the right-of-way design, you can't always flatten the earth because, it might be able to possible to flatten the earth in a on a site. It's not possible to flatten the entire earth. Okay. So, and because of that, we allow if the grade of the sidewalk is adjacent to an existing established right-of-way, an adjacent street, we allow the grade to exceed 5% and meet the grade of the meet the grade established for the adjacent street. So if the adjacent street is steeper, then we allow the sidewalk to follow that same slope. And if you think about it, that makes sense, because when you get to the crossing, if you aren't going at the same slope as the roadway next to you, you can't very well cross the road if you aren't going at the same slope as the road next to you. So that's the reason for that. Now, if it's not within a highway right of way, like a shared use path shown here, which is a nice little asphalt path that's going through an area and is a green area with trees all around, and it's quite wide, and that's if you're providing a sidewalk or a shared use path in that realm, when it's not associated with the roadway, then the maximum slope of that surface is 1 in 20. Although we do allow for alterations to address grade, existing grade. We don't expect to, again, for you to completely flatten the earth. But we do want you to try to keep the grade at 1 in 20 as much as possible. And I'm really kind of just giving you a real brief overview. I'm not really going into the nitty-gritty details. So there are some caveats to these things. This is the slope of the crossing or the crown of the road. The maximum pedestrian access route grade for when you're crossing a road is going to be 5%. That isn't any different than what is already in the ADA standards already, so that's pretty similar. Now, where the roadway design requires a super elevation, i.e. a road that has like banking for the turn, if you have a crosswalk on that kind of a road, which you usually don't, we allow the grade of the road to be steeper than 5% in those conditions. Again, recognizing that the world is not flat. The cross slope of the pedestrian access route contained within a crosswalk is based on what type of stop control is being provided at the intersection. With a yield or stop control, where you're always expected to stop when a pedestrian is in the crosswalk, then we require it to be this typical 1 to 48. Which you guys should be familiar with. Slope is basically a 2.1% slope. At uncontrolled approaches, which has no traffic control for the vehicles, we allow the cross slope to be as much as 1 in 20. And then with traffic control signals or a pedestrian hybrid beacon, it is also allowed to be at 1 in 20. And then if you have a mid-block crossing or a roundabout crossing, the cross slope of the crosswalk can't be greater than the street grade. Okay, so the cross slope of the pedestrian access route not contained within a crosswalk. This is the cross slope of like your standard sidewalk is not a is required to be 2% or 2.1%, 1 in 48. Okay. And the reason for that, we really try to hold you to the to that cross slope requirement because we're allowing the grade of the road to be to follow the slope of the roadway next to it. So we really want to try to keep the cross slope of that sidewalk to a low percentage of 1 to 48 so that you don't have a compound slope to deal with. And this is again new construction requirements. Alterations are to the maximum extent feasible. And this just this graphic is just showing you a sidewalk that's going along. On the left is a building, on the right is the road. And there's a nice little row of street trees between them, but there's a, but the cross slope or the slope opposite the running slope is held to a 2% or 2.1% slope. Now the surface of this, of the walkway has to meet the same old requirements as any other surface we typically specify in the ADA and Architectural Barriers Act world, is that the walking surface of the pedestrian access route is required to be stable, firm, and slip resistant. And this the graphic is just showing it's a drawing of a person's the down close to the road with a person in a wheelchair wheeling across. You can basically just see his legs and his feet and his wheels. It's not a full picture of the person, but it's just showing you that it's typically going to be concrete or asphalt that meets these requirements. So although it isn't limited to that, it's typically going to be that. You can also be brick depending on how it's been laid out. And this kind of comes to that is changes in level. Changes in level are changes in vertical vertical changes in the pedestrian access route are limited to a quarter inch without a treatment or a half inch if beveled with a slope no steeper than one in 20. Now, changes in level greater than a half an inch up to 6 inches must have a slope no greater than 1 in 12. Changes in level greater than 6 inches must be treated as a ramp. Usually you're not going to get that kind of change in level on the actual access route, except for where you cross, but that's where you put in a curb ramp. If you have horizontal openings in the ground surface, such as your metro grates that you see on the sidewalk or a tree grate, that kind of thing, the horizontal openings in ground surfaces, such as those in gratings and joints, other than flangeway gaps, should not allow passage of a sphere larger than a half an inch in diameter. And where multiple directions of travel intersect, then the elongated openings are permitted, but must be placed so that the long dimension is perpendicular to the dominant direction of travel. Okay. Now, flangeway gaps, when you're going over a railroad crossing, because of the way railroads are designed, you do have to provide for a flangeway gap. And if there's freight rail involved, the inside gap on the rail can be as much as 3 inches for light rail and other things not subject to FRA safety regulations. It is required to only be 2.5 inches. That's pretty standard to what you see in the world today. So, and regarding protruding objects, the vertical clearance for people with vision impairments, these are really no different than what's in the building guidelines. It's between 27 inches and 80 inches. It can only stick out 4 inches into the circulation path. We have added the fact that even if it's mounted on a pole, I don't know if anybody remembers this, but in the building guidelines, if it's mounted on a pole, it's permitted to extend 12 inches out from the pole. But if it's mounted on anything else, it's only allowed to stick out 4 inches. And what we've done here is we've required that 4 inches to apply what, no matter what it's mounted on, it's 4 inches of an extension. So I'm going to try to go a little bit faster here. Curb ramps and blended transitions at intersection, we require a curb ramp for every crossing. So we only allow a diagonal curb ramp when there's no other option. If you know what I mean by a diagonal curb ramp, it's a curb ramp that is at the apex of the corner and isn't serving either crossing very well. So at a standard four-way crossing, we would require two curb ramps at every corner in new construction, and then only allow a diagonal curb ramp when all the other options are exhausted in an alteration. So, and a mid-block or roundabout, curb ramps or blended transitions must be provided on both ends of the crosswalk. Where pedestrian crossing is prohibited, this is showing you an example of a sidewalk that's detached on the left. And so the sidewalk never comes up to the corner. So it's assumed you're not crossing to the upper crossing. There's no pedestrian crossing provided. If the sidewalk does come clear up to the curb, but you don't intend people to cross, there needs to be some sort of landscaping or barrier that prevents a person from crossing there. It doesn't keep an idiot from crossing because he can go around the barrier, of course, but it does prevent most people from crossing the road. I joking, you know, refer to idiots, so I'm sorry if anybody's offended by that. So perpendicular curb ramps. I'm gonna describe three different types of curb ramps here. One is perpendicular curb ramp. This is where the curb ramp is perpendicular to the curb. It is held to 1 to 12 maximum running slope. All the usual requirements. There is a difference in the right-of-way. Because of the slopes of roads, we do allow it to exceed 1 in 12 when it's going to take more than 15 feet to accomplish the elevation change. So that is one difference. And then, of course, the cross slope is held to 1 to 48 again. In the graphic, we show you a perpendicular curb ramp. It is perpendicular to the curb. It is parallel to the crosswalk, but perpendicular to the curb. And that's how we come up with perpendicular curb ramp, because we base it on which direction it is to the curb, not to the crossing. And then grade brakes must be flush. This is what we call a parallel curb ramp. It's used a lot in narrow right-of-way. And it is held to the same requirements, 1 in 12 slope. This shows you two ramps coming down to a common landing. And then the landing takes you to the crosswalk. And of course, the cross slope on that again is 1 to 48, and also the grade brakes must be flush. Now, this is the one that's different. We called them blended transitions because we didn't know what else to call them. We could have called them Scott, we could have called them George, we could have called them whatever we wanted to. We called them blended transitions. This is basically where you've depressed the entire corner or raised the crossing for the crosswalk. What we require here is that the slope of a blended transition cannot exceed 1 in 20. The running slope is less than our curb ramp. Blended transitions must be, the cross slope of a blended transition must be equal or less to the cross slope of the crosswalk as specified in 302.5. The bypass, if you have a situation where the blended transition has a slope of 5%, you need to have a bypass that makes it so that if somebody's just going around the corner and not actually using the blended transition, is able to do that without having to deal with a 5% cross slope. And I understand I'm going through this fairly quickly, but detectable warning surfaces is required at curb ramps and blended transitions. It basically, all a detectable warning does is warn a blind pedestrian that this is where the curb ramp would be if those guys in wheelchairs hadn't taken it away. It doesn't give directional information. It merely just says you're going from a safe condition to a to a traffic condition or vice versa, depending on which side of the detectable warning you're on. But they are required at all these locations. They must contrast visually with the adjacent surfaces. They extend 24 inches in the direction of pedestrian travel. They're required at curb ramps and blended transitions at an intersection, pedestrian at-grade rail crossings, boarding platforms and sidewalk and street level rail boarding and alighting areas, driveways and pedestrian refuge islands. They are not required at a bus stop, a standard curbside bus stop, unless the curb has been raised above standard curb height, and then it's considered a boarding platform, like for rapid transit or something like that. So pedestrian signal heads, pedestrian activated warning devices. We require, they must have a compliant walk indication, which includes the accessible pedestrian signal. We base the signal timing on a 3.5 feet per second, which is a half a second slower than what the MUTCD requires. MUTCD only, the manual on uniform traffic control devices from Federal Highway, which is a standard used for these things, only requires a 4 foot per second walking speed. That's a little faster. It allows for a 3.5 feet, but it's a should, not a shall. We make it a shall, 3.5 feet per second. And the walk interval must be a minimum of 7 seconds. This just shows you a, it's just a display of a don't walk signal with the number 6 next to it, because it's showing you only have 6 seconds left to cross. We do currently don't require an audible countdown. That's being considered in future versions, but not currently in this version. What we do require is that there be an audible and vibrotactile walk indication. And that is done with a what we call an accessible pedestrian signal. And I'm showing you in the graphic a photo of an accessible pedestrian signal. It basically gives you an arrow showing which direction the crossing is going to take you. And the device says, I'm sure you've seen a few in DC, the device usually says, walk sign is on to cross Lincoln Avenue or whatever street it is, 13th Street. And it says that all through the walk indication, and then it switches to back to the locator tone for the clearance interval and for the don't walk interval. And there's also the option of a rapid tick instead of the verbal message. So we do require a clear space compliant with 404 at the operable part. That's basically a wheelchair clear floor space, reach range compliant with the reach range requirements for forward reach and side reach, unobstructed. It should be operable with one hand and not require tight grasping, pinching, or twisting of the wrist. This is showing you, these two graphics are showing you the old style, which was like a little tiny button that you kind of stick your finger in the hole and hope that the only thing in there is a button, as opposed to the better buttons now that they use, which are more the size of your hand, where you can just whack it with your hand and not have to have great dexterity with your hands to be able to do this, point your finger. So that's the type of devices we're requiring. If on-street parking is provided, it is required to meet the requirements unless it's exclusively for residential parking. We also have some exceptions for commercial or law enforcement vehicles. If the parking space is altered, it has to meet certain requirements until the minimum number of accessible on-street parking spaces is met from the table in R211, which is basically a one for every 25 spaces. So here's the chart. It shows you 1 to 25 requires one accessible space. It's very similar to the same chart that's in for buildings. The dimensions, we have a specific dimension for the parking space. Parallel on-street parking is 24 feet long by 13 feet wide. we do allow for some exceptions for that. And the center 50% of the length of the sidewalk or other surface adjacent to an accessible parking space must be free of obstructions. That's so a person can deploy a ramp or a lift onto the sidewalk. This graphic just shows you a car parked parallel parked in a parking space with the center 50% of the parking area clear of any landscaping or any street furniture, that kind of thing. So, sorry, I'm trying to go a little fast. Perpendicular on-street parking is very similar to the building guidelines. I will share this show with you guys so you can look at it in detail and contact me if you have questions. The angled on-street parking spaces have a specific width requirement, 132 inches wide, an access aisle of 60 inches, which comes to a total of 16 feet because it's 11 feet plus 5 feet. Similar to what's required in on a parking lot. The sign must be a 60-inch minimum above the ground surface measured to the bottom of the sign. Passenger loading zones are treated basically the same way as parking. There are some exceptions to the requirements for providing the accessible passenger loading zone, but if they're provided, the middle 50% has to be clear of obstructions, just like you would expect. Boarding and alighting areas of buses is required. Basically the same as what's required in the building requirements is a 96 by 60 space that for boarding and alighting for a wheelchair. This graphic just shows you a bus pulled up to a bus stop with a guy in a wheelchair going up the ramp and getting ready to go for a ride on the bus. And the slope requirement perpendicular to the street is held to the 2.1% maximum, and the slope parallel to the street can match the street grade. So there also are provisions for transit shelters if provided. They aren't required to be provided, but if they are provided, they have to meet certain requirements, including a 30-inch by 48-inch clear space entirely within the shelter, so that if it's raining, I can actually stay out of the rain as well as everybody else. Ramp rise and ramp landings is very similar to the building guidelines. It's 30-inch maximum rise. Again, I'm trying to go through this fairly quickly. We're almost done here. Stairs, we have an additional requirement. If there's stairs in the right-of-way in the pedestrian access route, we have a requirement for a visual strip, be it it has to contrast with its surrounding surface and be and provide a contrasting strip so that a person who has low vision can tell that these are steps and where the steps are. And they also have to meet the stairs have to meet the same requirements as building stairs inside of a building, which is a 4 to 7 inch riser height and 11 inch tread depth. And open risers are not permitted. Pedestrian signs, it's meant for the pedestrian to use it. It has to meet our requirements for visual signs, so it's intended solely for the pedestrians. There are some exceptions to that, transit schedules, timetables, and maps. Signs that are mounted immediately above or incorporated into push-button detector unit, those are all required to comply. Of course, the international symbol of accessibility is required in the same places that they typically are in buildings. I'm sorry, I am going fast, but I know I'm running out of time. So if there's a bench provided, you have to provide a clear space within the space. I already mentioned that. Benches not at transit stops or shelters. We don't really have requirements for benches, street benches, furniture. But we do require, if you've provided a bench, that there be a clear space next to it for a person in a wheelchair to park next to the bench. So that if he's there with his sweetheart and she wants to sit on the bench and I want to pull up close to her, I can do that. Or if you're just with friends, you want to be able to watch people walk by, you can do that together. So I'm being a little glib with my descriptions, but let's try to lighten, trying to lighten up the mood. So here's the contact information. I'll leave that up as we're talking about questions, but do I have just a minute for questions, guys?
We're going to intrude into the next agenda item, but I think Dr. Butler won't mind, since we may be able to also intrude into later parts of the agenda. If you could go to the pictures that you were shown, one of them is, and can we bring that up now?
Yeah, I'll get that up. Just give me a second.
Yeah, the Greensboro exit, station exit, empties right onto a street where, unfortunately, there's no sidewalk. That's it.
Talking about here, right?
Yes, that the top picture
the
there.
Graphic's a little small, but it basically shows a road with a curb, a yellow curb, no sidewalk, and just grass up to the building. So there's no pedestrian facility provided to any great degree.
And it starts at the exit of a metro station. Someone leaving that exit would have to walk virtually in the street in order to get to the commercial parts of the parking lot down below. What can be done about that? I mean, you have to walk in the street, and there's a car right there you can see.
I'm sorry. I was trying to talk to get my light turned on, having my Alexa turn my light on, so I didn't want to hear that. So I muted and I forgot. So the situation here is, unfortunately, the ADA can't require them to install a sidewalk. But what we say is, if the sidewalk is provided, it has to be accessible. If this is near a transit stop, though, the argument can be made that they're putting in a pedestrian generator, which is, i.e., the transit stop, because you wouldn't be riding transit if you drove a car everywhere you went. You wouldn't need to ride transit. So the whole purpose of transit is to be able to serve pedestrians, and a lot of situations you'd need to provide a sidewalk to that. Montgomery County, Maryland, several years ago, realized that if they provided a sidewalk to the nearest intersection from a bus stop or a transit stop, and they could pay for the cost of that sidewalk, if they got one person, if all they'd have to do is get one person off of a paratransit, which is door-to-door service because of the transit system not being accessible. But unfortunately, the ADA we don't really have the ability to say you have to provide a sidewalk. Now, safety would probably tell you do have to provide a sidewalk. But again, the ADA isn't a safety regulation. It's more of a civil rights regulation. So, if everybody has to walk in the street, then everybody has to walk in the street. The problem is not everybody walks in the street. Someone will walk in the grass, and people who use wheelchairs can't do that. So it is a little bit of a problem. And DOJ and DOT, when they adopt the standards, may be able to do something with that. But we as the access board can't require a sidewalk where you aren't providing one. Do you understand what I mean?
Yes. And the next picture also shows the sidewalk, a brick sidewalk, which is so narrow. Mesh fence. What can be done about
this? This would be a violation of the guidelines, because they're providing a pedestrian facility, but it's narrower than the minimum width, and so they would need to address this. I don't know why the fence is there. The fence, I don't know what it's there for.
Protecting a tree, but in any event, one could call upon the access board's guidelines to require somebody to either take down that fence or to do something else to widen it? So that
there's at least 4 feet between these two fences.
Okay.
The fence on the, you know, the fence that's along the building and the chain link fence that's in the middle of the sidewalk.
Okay, and the third one deals with a bus stop?
Yeah, the third one, go ahead, you can describe it if you want to.
Basically, there's so much shrubbery and that you can see it goes even beyond the bus stop itself, and one should be able to stand at least at the bus stop, but you can't there. And it's crowded the sidewalk so that it would be difficult, for example, for a wheelchair to easily angle itself to get onto the lift of a bus. What should be done about that situation?
Well, I assume that this is probably a situation where the sidewalk is much wider than what we're seeing because the shrubbery is overgrown on the sidewalk. And this is a maintenance of accessible features, which is a provision that's in DOJ and DOT's regulations already, is that they have to maintain the accessibility of a facility. And that means cutting back the shrubbery. I used to do some trainings like what I'm doing today with a guy from Chicago who worked for the Chicago Department of Transportation. And he would go around with a pair of clippers and basically just, you just clip the shrubbery if it was encroaching on his right of way. So the jurisdiction, whether it be in Maryland, Virginia, or DC, should be either making the adjoining property owner cut back his shrubbery, or they'll come and just do it for you and, you know, possibly charge you for it. But that's maintenance of accessible features. That's part of DOT and DOJ's regulation already, and we would continue to require that with the public rights of way. So
okay. Other members, Anu, are there any hands up from members?
We don't have any hands up, but if any members of the AAC have any questions, please either raise your hand or you can come off of mute and state your comments.
Yeah, and I'm totally sorry I had to go so quick through the thing. Here's my contact information again, I'll put up here. I see Darnese has a question.
Right. And I just want to read a comment before Darnese makes hers. Dr. Butler stated that her update is brief because she's limited to what she can share. So we can take time as needed for this topic. Okay, Pat. So we'll take Darnese and then Patrick. Darnese,
hello, Darnese Bush. I think that I missed it, but how wide is the sidewalk required to be? Is it supposed to be 4 feet?
It's a minimum 4 feet under the public right-of-way guidelines. In the old standards for buildings and facilities, it was only required to be 3 feet wide. We added a foot to it mainly because in a hallway, you get close to the edge, you might scrape some wallpaper off the wall or some paint off the wall. But if you get close to the edge on a sidewalk, you're going off the edge of the curb.
You're gonna fall over, yeah.
It's a little more catastrophic than just scraping some paint off the wall. So,
is that because most wheelchairs, the width of the wheelchair is usually 36 inches, like between 33 and 36 inches?
It's to allow for some error, you know, when you're out in the right of way and you're dealing with a cross slope and a running slope. But it's much steeper than it is inside of a building. It's a margin for error to at least provide a little bit of wiggle room. And that's a minimum requirement. And it's exclusive of the curb, which is important because usually a curb is 6 inches wide. So we're actually requiring 4.5 feet if you count the curb, but it's 4 feet exclusive of the curb. And that has to be clear. So the other thing is we try not to have a blind pedestrian be basically a pinball machine between furnishings, and you have to go, you know, zigzag left and right through the space. We want to try to keep it as straight as possible, although we don't require it to be straight. That's the best
way to do it and not have to zigzag through this space, if you understand what I'm saying.
So in the case of most walkways outside, that you say in the curb is really not included in the summary of the
Our width requirement, it doesn't include the curb, so it'd be 4 feet plus the curb. Do you understand what I mean?
Yes. Yes, I do now. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And again, that's typically what's provided in most places because that's been a requirement of the industry for years as a 4 foot wide sidewalk, so minimum. So it's not an impossibility for people to provide. It just, it's a maintenance issue, like Tino's presentation was, or images were showing, is you just got to maintain that surface.
But sometimes it's hard to determine because there's so much construction in a district. Exactly. That people have to.
And we address.
Roll in the street because the fencing and the protective barriers are out in the street. So that pushes wheelchair users and blind people all the way in the middle of the street.
Yeah. And I didn't put that in this presentation, but there is a provision in the public right-of-way guidelines that talks about routes around construction zones and how they have to meet a certain level of requirement as well. So we do require a route around construction zones.
Okay. Maybe share that with us at a later date.
Yeah. And like I said, you can send questions to our ROW@access-board.gov. That's the email address you want to send it to, is ROW@access-board.gov. Sandy, do you have a question?
I did, yeah.
Patrick. I'm sorry, Patrick has a question. Then Sandy. Go ahead, Patrick.
Okay, thank you much. Appreciate that. First, Scott, I just want to say what an excellent job you're doing with the International Code Council there. Appreciate the sites that you've been giving us for the last, it's been 2 years or something like that, with all those various topics. I've learned a lot. I think I might have missed it, but the next steps for the for these regulations going forward, what are we waiting on? Next steps, and when do we get see some movement on it?
Yeah, the next steps are in Department of Transportation and Department of Justice's court. We are done. Okay.
So
as you know, there's a two-step process with the ADA. The standard setting agencies, Department of Justice and Department of Transportation, have to go through their rulemaking process. And it is in their unified agenda. You guys might want to look this up. You can Google the two words unified agenda, and it will come up. They just published the latest unified agenda, and I didn't get a chance to look dates. But they both DOT and DOJ have dates for when they expect to have a proposed rule for adoption of these standards. And I believe it's in 2020, like I'm vaguely remembering the middle of the year, 2024.
So, okay. Oh, that's good. Okay. And they're both of the access board. So they've heard all of this before.
Yeah. It shouldn't take too long. It just depends on how many people write in complaints and, you know, during the rulemaking process, or, you know, want them to change stuff. But they can't go below our guidelines, though. When they set that under the ADA, when they set their standard, and it's the same way for the ABA, the ABA is dealt with by four different standard setting agencies: the U.S. Postal Service, the General Services Administration, the Department of Defense, and HUD. When they set their standards, all six of the standard setting agencies we deal with cannot go below our guidelines. So if we say 5% of something has to be accessible, they can say 6, 10, 12, you know, whatever they want to say, but they can't say 4.
Good. Beautiful. So
they raise the requirement, but they can't lower it.
Good. Nice to have a floor. Good. Thank you, sir. Appreciate that.
No problem. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you.
Miss
Sandy. This is Sandy News Out.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. Could you, I know you're going to send this around to us, but could you refresh me about signs sticking out into the sidewalk? You're advocating for a 4-inch maximum, even if it's attached to a post?
That is correct. So awesome. What happens is with these, you know, those constructions of the signs that they put up in the sidewalk to tell drivers that there's, you know, that there's construction ahead, those, they can still be on the pole and they can still stick out for more than 4 inches. But if they do, they have to have a base on them that is cane detectable, and they can only stick out 4 inches from the base or 4 inches from the pole, one or the other. Okay. So, and the base has to be tall enough to be cane detectable. So hopefully it'll help with the situation. I had a colleague, I had a colleague who I used to work with at the access board who was blind, and he came in one day with a big old gouge in the middle of his forehead because he'd ran into one of those diamond signs that says road construction ahead that was set out in the sidewalk for drivers. I'd like to see them not stick them in the sidewalk, but that's a whole nother discussion. So,
okay. Can I ask sort of part two, and you've sort of addressed it. What about temporary signage? Like a restaurant puts out a sandwich board on the sidewalk, and temporary sidewalk furniture where restaurants and cafes put out tables and make the sidewalk narrower than 48 inches.
They can't do that. If you're going to narrow it below 48, they can't do that. And if it's going to be sticking out off a pole, it can only stick out the 4 inches or a base, you know, on them. And that base can't reduce the clear width either. So.
Okay, so then part three is the temporary sloppy discourteousness of electric scooter riders just leaving their electric scooters in the middle of a sidewalk. Can this possibly be used to address that and enforce better behavior?
I would love it if we could do that because I hate those things. as a wheelchair user, I hate them. I can't imagine what it's like to be blind and have to deal with them. But yes, if they're put in the way, they're violating things. And I've suggested to DOT, who has some jurisdiction over these things, is to require the companies that provide them to charge people when they don't park them properly. There's ways to do that because they know exactly where they're at and they know exactly how they've been parked. They could just, you know, add a, you know, a large go park it in the right place. I think that would help a lot. But that's just my thoughts on it.
Okay. Thank you for all of this. This is very encouraging.
Yeah, so Rico, I understand you have a question.
Yes. Is your board is open to the public?
I'm sorry?
Is your board open to the public?
Yeah, our board meetings are. The board is set up. It's 25-member board. I'm a staff member. I'm not a board member. But our board of directors is a 25-member board, 13 public members appointed by the president. So you need to know somebody to get appointed. And over 50% of them have to be people with disabilities. And then the other 12 are federal members, like the Undersecretary of Civil Rights for the Department of Justice, the Undersecretary of Civil Rights for the Department of Transportation, and so on. So it's a 25-member board. It's set up for 13 public and 12 federal. That's so that if there's ever a, you know, a situation where it's the public against the federal government, the public will always win because there's 13 votes for the public and 12 for federal. It was designed that way on purpose. And so, but our meetings are open to the public. Yes, our board meetings are, and we webcast them as well.
Another question: If a customer is deaf, who do we let know about providing access, like the interpreter service? Who do we contact? I'm very curious because I want to attend one of your board members meetings. I want to, and I need to know How do I do that? Who do I call for providing a sign language interpreter?
We have sign language interpreters.
And is it course captions also online?
Yeah, we at all of our public board meetings, we have a sign language interpreter and CART, or caption. So we have both of those all the time. You don't even have to ask for them; you just automatically have them.
Okay. And do you know when is our next board meeting?
Our next board meeting, I want to say, is January 22nd through the 24th, but it is on our website. And our web address is on the page right here that I'm showing. So
we're over 20 minutes.
Active-board.gov.
We're over 20 minutes into the next agenda.
Okay, I'll stop. Thank you.
any last question of a member? Okay, if not, Scott. Thank you, Scott, and assume that we'll be able to keep the video that you showed, make it available to our membership.
I'll be glad to send that to your secretary. So
sure. Anu, the next agenda item is?
Yes, so we have low floor, heavy duty transit hybrid electric bus solicitation, and Dr. Butler will lead that discussion.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Maggie Butler, the Vice President of System-Wide Accessibility here at WMATA. I'm a middle-aged African-American woman wearing a black and white sweater with shoulder-length hair. I wanted to provide a brief update about WMATA's current bus procurement process. In April 2023, WMATA shared a public solicitation for their low-floor, heavy-duty transit hybrid electric buses. And at this time, they are reviewing the responders' bids. In 2024, members of the AAC will have the opportunity to tour the selected bus for their review and comment. And as I said, this is a very brief update. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my update.
Do you know when they will be available for review?
We do not have that information. I am sitting on that committee, so I do not have that information at this time. But as soon as I have that, I will share that with Anu so she can schedule you all's attendance.
Great. Thank you. Very any well. Other members?
Don't have any hands up at this point.
This is Sandy. I can't find my hands up button. May I ask a question?
Go ahead, Sandy.
I don't mean to be controversial. I'm just trying to understand the process of why the AAC will only be brought in once you've selected a contract. Does that presume that there are still options for changing accessibility-ness of the bus, or does that assume that all potential contracts had equal accessibility on the buses? I don't understand why we're just invited at the very last minute after some major decision has been made.
Good question. So
what I can share is moving forward, what we'd like for you all to do is be a part of the solicitation process that has passed. And so we do still have the opportunity for you all to provide comments and share information for changes at that stage. But moving forward, you all will be engaged in the solicitation process where we can get your insight ahead of time. And I think that might have happened in January of 2023. But this is where we are at this moment. So there will still be an opportunity for you to share your input and for changes to be made.
Okay, thank you.
That was a good question, Sandy. And Maggie, in the past, we sometimes have been notified after decisions were made. What do we think of the product that was decided upon? And we hope that, as Sandy indicates, that things won't be foreclosed because decisions are already made.
Right. And so And Mr. Chairman, I will say this. The reason why we're bringing this to you now is so that we can be a little more proactive in that process. So, of course, I would have loved for you all to be a part of the solicitation earlier in the year. But again, moving forward, we will make sure that you all are aware of those solicitations before they go out so that you can provide input. And then again, you will be able to provide comment for changes moving forward for this current process.
Well, thank you. And as a matter of fact, you probably were not on board when some of these decisions or the process was proceeding. Any other questions from members of about this question of solicitations?
Chair, this is Anu. I do not see any other hands up at this point.
Okay. If not, then we are just about back on schedule. The next discussion is about the U.S. Department of Transportation seeking input regarding accessibility at transit facilities. Now, I wasn't involved in the selection of this topic, but by transit facilities, do they also mean, for example, bus stops and stations, or what is implied by transit facilities? Anu?
Okay, so this was a request for information, and this apparently was also public knowledge. I had shared an email with information about this, as had Sandy. And this, I'm trying to locate my email from when I had sent it, but this was basically requesting information. So if you would give me a moment, I can probably pull up my email.
Sandy's aware of it too. Sandy, yes. By facilities, what is up for discussion?
So Tina, this is Sandy. I'm embarrassed to say the last couple of days has been really crazy and I have not re-reviewed this. But when I first saw the survey, it was a very in-depth decision tree. You could comment about a myriad of things, you know, buses, metro rail, signage, And there was a lot of open-endedness to it that you could make comments. It was so open-ended that I just sort of threw up my hands and I'm like, maybe I need to pick one topic that I want to comment about, and it would be signage.
Okay, signage is a good one. Incidentally, Alexandria has petitioned people to comment on what appears to be a model bus shelter, and I will share with the membership a photo of this bus shelter. Alexandria is asking for comment on it. We've been involved, we've engaged in such discussions in the past. I'm sorry that Phil is not on board with this afternoon, but that's been a constant matter of discussion regarding the benches in bus shelters and that sort of thing. I've got it, and I will share the Alexandria model. Yes, Anu.
Chair Calabria, this is Anu. So Carol Paradi-Lopez, Director of Office of ADA Policy, raised her hand. She probably would like to share some information. Sure. And Dr. Posner is on this meeting.
Oh, okay, good. Carol?
Good evening. I'm Carol Lopez. I am Hispanic female with dark hair and wearing a dark jacket. We have read part of that, and I think Sandy was looking into the signage aspect of it. But one of the questions that we were asked had to do with the redundancy of elevators and in transit stations. They wanted to know How many agencies required more than one elevator at a metro entrance, at a subway entrance? And it looks like there may be two or three agencies in the country that require two elevators, such as our requirement. We require two elevators when there's a level change. And that was one of the questions. And they also had a question about how do people feel about having one elevator and a ramp so that, you know, if the elevator goes out of service, you use a ramp. And that was the most controversial question that I thought. I think that WMATA looks at having two elevators because if one breaks, the other one hopefully will be working. And that's what our new standard for new installations is. But I think they were asking, how do people feel about just having one elevator and then a ramp to get into a station?
And so if the single elevator is out of service, people would be forced to use the ramp, the only other access?
Yeah, that was something that they were considering. They just threw it out there for people to comment,
who threw it there?
I think the FDA has been asking that.
Well, as I mentioned last week, we were lucky that Richard Heidinger forced WMATA to build one elevator, which hadn't been considered when the development of our metro system first installed. If the standard is two, or in any event, the standard ought to be two, or else you'd be stuck with a broken elevator, and then wheelchairs, for example, would have to go down a ramp. Is this the only other kind of issue that we should be talking about?
I just mentioned it as being the most controversial. We in WMATA have the standard with the two elevators. There are some instances where it's impossible to fit two elevators in a particular situation, in an existing station in particular. So if we try to upgrade something, we definitely put two elevators. We have studies, and you've had presentations from the planning office about adding more elevators in our system beyond the ones that we have, right? But the other thing was FDA request. I guess they were asking about elevator maintenance, reliability, feasibility of two elevators. That was what really stuck to me as being a difficult challenge. I haven't looked into we haven't researched what Sandy was talking about, so I'm going to yield to her concerns.
Carol, if it's helpful, I'll be happy to share my screen for the convenience of all the members. And
sure. Please do.
Okay, give me one second.
And Phil's on board, so Phil, if you have anything to add, please do.
Okay, I believe so Dr. Posner has raised his hand, and Mr. Wendley is also would like to make some comments. So Dr. Posner, go ahead.
Let me defer. Thank you, Tino, for asking me, and the discussion's going nicely, so why don't you let it continue? And if I have anything to add, I will add it at the end.
Sure, Phil, thank you. Who else is asking to be heard?
Scott Windley raised his hand. So Mr. Windley, I think you're trying to add some information. Go ahead, please.
Great.
I just wanted to mention, because I don't remember it being mentioned, but the comment period ends January 5th for this rule from DOT, and I would encourage since I don't work for DOT, I can say this, but I would strongly encourage y'all to comment on this rule. That's the whole purpose of the comment period, it's a proposed rule, it's getting information. So it's the beginning of the thing, and it's a time for you guys to make the comments that you need to make, like, you know, automatic doors on the entry, things like that, you know. I would just encourage you to answer the questions they have and just submit any kind of comments you have, because, you know, the more comments they have, it's always better to have more information than you need. I can tell you, as a regulatory agency, it's easier to do something if you've got the comments to back it up. So if you think two elevators, for example, is better than an elevator and a ramp, you need to say that so that when FTA makes their decision, they can say, based on public comment, we have decided to do this. Do you know what I mean? It's a lot easier to swallow if there's public comments to go along with it. So,
Scott, you may know that when Hettinger was trying to force WMATA to build even just one elevator per station, it was refused. And one of the key members who was refusing it said that people who use wheelchairs should be trained to go up and down on the escalators.
That's dangerous.
he argued that you people in wheelchairs should be trained to go up and down on escalators. Give me a break. But thank you for telling us about the deadline, and we will try and put together something before that deadline. Sandy, do you have anything to add?
Well, I don't think that this is this is not directed specifically at WMATA. This is for consideration for guidance in the future for the FTA, the Federal Transit Authorities.
So
I believe.
Yeah, remember, it's not just WMATA, but I think if this committee, I'm sorry I interrupted, but I think this committee could easily make comments that could affect all of the transit agencies, not just WMATA. Yeah.
Yes, and the point I was trying to make was we're a committee, but we could have a voice of 20 responses, and I think it would be better if every individual made a response. I think that would be more impactful than saying we, the AAC, spent a lot of time consulting, and the consensus is that probably this is the best. I personally, and everybody else on the AAC can say I'm wrong, but I personally think we'd have a louder voice if each one of us responded to this survey.
Absolutely. And that's why I'm urging everybody to respond regarding the fiscal cliff and addressing their jurisdictions, the state of Maryland, the state of Virginia, and the District of Columbia. The more of us that individually say something, the bigger the effect will be. I agree with you entirely, Sandy. Phil, having had a chance now to hear some of us, do you want to add anything?
Yes, to go along with what was already said, which I think is great, as individuals, and I agree, the most individual comments, the better. And I might suggest we take a look at what WMATA has done as their standard for bus stops accessibility, and the things that we heard tonight from the accessibility board, because not only the bus stop accessibility and the shelter accessibility, but also how do you get to the shelter?
Yes.
Also, one thing that I'm truly troubled by is the idea of using a ramp as an auxiliary to an elevator. Well, the stations that we have at DuPont Circle or at Ross Lynn or at L'Enfant Plaza, I can't imagine a ramp. would have to be several hundred feet long in order to get the grade safe enough to put a wheelchair on or anything on it. And so if they're thinking about a suggestion of an elevator or a ramp, they have to take into account what grade that ramp would be. And in some of these, it's impossible. Or in stations like L'Enfant and Rosslyn, where there is a mezzanine, then there is a track, and then there is a second track or a third track. So that may require multiple elevators to go from one to another. So once you get from the street at Rosslyn into the station, you then have to take an escalator to get to the main area and then a second one to get down to where the trains are. So I think that sort of a discussion needs to be made available to the committee that's writing the rule. But those are definitely my comments. And I hadn't forwarded it today, but along with what Tino has said, there is a letter going around of writing a letter to the governor of Virginia about the fiscal cliff. And so once again, I suggest all Virginia residents take time to write to their governor or email to their governors. Email is quicker because it'll get there, because the mails generally go into a bucket that doesn't get opened for quite some time. So that's it. I've said more than I should. But thank you, Tino. You're doing a great job.
Well, thank you, Phil. Could I add, I just checked. The next meeting is right before the deadline of the federal department. The next meeting, I guess, would be on Tuesday the 2nd, the deadline being that Friday, which is only 3 days away. So number one, individuals should write, but Sandy and Phil, could you help us compose some items that should be included in the individual letters? I'll try to do so also, or all members should do so. But Sandy has given some thought to this, and Phil, I know, has some ideas too.
Happy to help.
Yeah, so Phil, thank you for offering to help. And Sandy, could you too offer ideas that could be shared with individual members of the committee so that they'll have something to send out on their own?
And maybe, yes, maybe. I could, as I go through this more seriously myself, I could perhaps highlight things that I think the AAC members would be, and it would be me second guessing what they might be most interested in commenting about, things that we've been hearing repeatedly. But again, this is advisory information to be taken forward by FTA, DOT, for future planning, but this is the sort of stuff that might help underpin standards for public transportation that's accessible, a little bit like, you know, years have gone into the standards that are in process that we were hearing about today, but from the Access Board, you know, that are trying to be put into enforceable standards of law requirements. So it would behoove us to similarly comment on this survey to help put the information behind future standards that would help in accessible transportation for all in the United States.
And Sandy, since you're well versed in questions related to lighting for people with low vision or partly blind people, maybe you could add that to the kit. They might not be considering lighting, but let's push what we know about some of the issues related to light. And that goes for you too, Pat. You've been involved with some outside groups regarding lighting, colors and such. So, Patrick, if you could give us some hints as to what we all could comment as individuals, as well as maybe even package something which can be approved at the January 2nd meeting, so that we not only have individuals sending in letters, but we have a combined position voiced by the AAC or the BRS. I'd appreciate that. Let's see. Are there any other comments on this issue? I'm glad we brought it up. I'm glad that Phil is willing, as well as Sandy, and I'm hoping that Patrick will help out with individual items that should go to the recipient federal agency. Anyone else?
Chair Calabia, I do not see any other hands up. But just to reiterate that if anyone is interested in submitting their comments, the deadline is Friday, January 5th, 2024.
Yes.
Now.
Yeah, Patrick, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Scott's very well aware of what we're talking about as far as stairways and some of that contrast. He mentioned it at the beginning when he was going through some of the PROAG requirements. I'll also say that Carol has talked to me a little bit about contrast, color contrast, with respect to signage within the transportation facility, and it certainly is an area of interest that there's a lot of opinions on, and one of the things that this International Code Commission does that I referenced with Scott was they talk about housing and indoor facilities and what they're doing as far as signage is concerned, as far as contrast and size of the signage and placement of the signage, and the same thing with stairs. So there's a lot of discussion going on with respect to that. But one of the things that I've seen in the blindness community is that Scott represented very nicely the color contrast, color contrast on stairs, and also the width of the stair of the stripes at the top of the stairs, and that sort of thing. One of the things that the blindness community is looking to do over the next couple of years is to get some data so that they can understand and have sort of some empirical data as to how effective that kind of color contrast is on stairways. And a lot of times over the years, and we're talking 10, 15, 20 years, there have been various studies that have not been as exacting as they might have been. And so we're seeing a lot of that going on. I think in the blindness community, we'll get some studies where we can look at the data over the next maybe 2-3 years and make some recommendations based on visually impaired, low vision individuals and their ability to travel safely, particularly in the using the stairways. The other things that have come up that we've talked about in as far as areas of interest, things like truncated domes, signage, and all of that. Carol has indicated to me that WMATA has gone above and beyond what is required by ADA, and I find that very useful. It is complicated, the regulations that they have out there. It's nice to know that WMATA is attempting to go above and beyond that. And also, I think what we've seen as far as signage is concerned, the two or three presentations we had in the early fall is indicating that over the next year, we're going to see more signage, which is going to be easier to understand, but we'll have better color contrast. One of the things that I was impressed about, Tina, was that the signage by Sarah that she brought to us was sort of a compilation of what's out there as far as Europe and Asia and different other areas that had good signage and was very effective. So I applaud that effort. I think it's going to be clearer and easier. I appreciate the work that the folks, particularly folks that have low vision, are doing with respect to signage and getting the word back to WMATA in that area. That's an area that I appreciate the work, but I can't give any meaningful input into. But I also appreciate, Carol, your exacting attention to standards going forward. And I think, you know, I think we're in good shape from what I hear, from what I see, Tino. Stair striping is something that you wouldn't believe how much discussion there has been on that. But it's something that we will be actually looking at moving forward with getting more empirical data on, and going back to the International Code Commission to talk about actually within the next 2 to 4 weeks, I believe.
Terrific. Patrick, you mentioned the stairs business. With respect to color or other aspects of vision, you mentioned that there are a number of ideas that have been floated. None has been decided upon. Well, but if you could mention one or two or three that are up for grabs, maybe our letters could indicate what they are. And, you know, we don't have to remain silent just because there's no decision made by an authoritative body, but we could reflect what some of the best thinking is. If you could mention what some of the two or three options are that have been discussed at some length, we could include those in our letters, okay. Not just one, because that would be look like we're pushing just one, but some of the better options that have been discussed thus far. Pat?
I think the language that I've seen so far that has been agreed on by a lot of people, and I guess we'll find that out in the next couple of weeks when we talk about it at this committee, is high contrast. High contrast not being defined by a particular number, like let's say 70% color contrast, which is something that I would like to see, because something like that between the light and dark areas, 70% color contrast is measurable and repeatable, but there are folks that don't like the high color contrast ratio defined in such an exacting way. That's one way to look at it, using subjective language like high color contrast, dark on white, white on dark is another way to look at it. There is a more technical version of color contrast called light reflective value, and they have a number of that they say is 50, and that sort of equates to the same color contrast ratio of 70% or so. So you have different measures, and that's where the complexity really comes in. But for right now, I think that what the committee has agreed on was high color contrast, so that you're looking at dark on white or light on dark, dark on light type thing. And I think that certainly individuals who can appreciate the signage and looking at that, or looking at the striping on stairs, would appreciate at least a high color contrast. One of the issues that low vision individuals have stressed to the committee is that this is not just an appearance issue, but for individuals who are low vision, it is a safety issue. And so the groups that I have worked with on the committee have done a really, really good job in impressing a lot of the architects that are there that high color contrast is, you know, whether it's truncated domes or whether it's stair striping or whatever, is not just an aesthetic issue, it's a safety issue as far as going forward. I'm sure there are others on this, you know, on this committee who are much more effective at describing that part of it than I am. But I'm just indicating what I have heard as far as testimony is concerned.
Yeah, if you could package a couple of the options. We're not saying that we've concluded ourselves that this is the best option, but if, at least if you could list some of the options, we could use those in our letters and force them to come to grips with this. Right. Any other?
The only other thing I would say is I think it's important for us to listen to what Carol has to say about the current standards going forward that that WMATA is using, if we're looking at facilities within the metro system, I think that that would be useful.
Yes, Carol, you could mention what that is, and that will be options that we could include. Again, we don't want to package something as if we've already decided, and whether it be WMATA's or somebody else. No, we're going to push the best thinking thus far, and that might be two or three options. So if you could help us with one of those, the one that that WMATA is considering at the moment as best, please do. And we'll use that in our individual letters as well as hopefully a view of the bus rail sub, well, the AAC, which could be sent on January 5th.
Tino, this is Carol. I just wanted to let you know, because of the AAC advocacy and due to your advocacy, even when we come up with high contrast solutions, this committee has made comments and we've gone back and have them change the contrast even higher. So currently we have white lettering with black background. Sometimes it's a dark gray, but even the gray we've changed because we've presented to the committee and the committee said we needed to be higher contrast. So that's how we have accomplished what has happened. Our signage has very dark brown background, as you know, the Metro Brown, and with white lettering. So we keep advocating to the designers that that's what the committee wants. That's how we've gone to not just 70%, but a higher contrast rating, mostly to make it higher contrast. So I can provide some information. Right. I mean, I'd coordinate with Ms. Butler and see what we can do.
Okay, but also let us know, because we're the ones who are writing individual letters.
Absolutely. That's what I was saying, is that we will provide you some information.
Okay. Sandy, you seem to nod in agreement.
Yes, but I want to stress that low vision people and all people with all disabilities, each one of us is unique. And what is best for us, as each of us as an individual, may not be best for everyone. Yes, it is appropriate to come to some sort of consensus that is most helpful to the majority of people. And I think putting a consensus together for WMATA is very helpful. But for this larger survey for the Federal Transit Authority, just my opinion, I think it'd be perfectly okay if each of us as an individual answered it. You know, if we don't know what to answer and we want to just, you know, copy and paste in what Carol has suggested, you know, has come to, you know, some suggestions from Carol or from Patrick or whatever, that's great. But I really think that they are looking for answers that you could speak up as an individual and say what works best for you. And then they will take the FTA, the DOT will take this information from a larger body and they'll come up with, you know, the best consensus they see. And, you know, it's freedom of speech, for goodness sake.
Excellent point. And as an individual writing to them, you could say what you think is best. I know you give lessons on how to help low vision people. You give them regular lessons right here in my neighborhood. Right. So I trust you on these matters. You're an individual. When you write an individual letter, you know, say what you think individually. You can allude to the fact that there are other opinions, but, you know, I'm thinking, though, that possibly there could be a statement that is presented by the AAC, and there we would recognize there's a variety at the moment.
True. And people who use wheelchairs really need to speak up, because I'm pretty clueless when it comes to that. You know, we need people who have mobility issues speaking right. up on what makes public transportation accessible.
Sure, right. Ambulatory problems in general, not just wheelchair users, but people who use canes or walkers, etc. We've accomplished a lot, actually, I think, as long as we follow through with individual letters and with possibly a letter from the AAC. It is 5:46. Do we have any public comment, people wanting to make public comments?
Flavia, this is Anu. We can ask for any members of the public if they like to make comments. Scott Windley has raised his hand. I believe he was trying to make add comments to the topic. And while Mr. Windley makes his comments, I would ask if any members of the public who have joined this meeting would like to make any comments, please do raise your hand so that we can call out your names. Mr. Windley?
Yeah. Thank you, Anu. I was debating with myself whether to say this or not, but I'm going to go ahead and do it. Is that I can tell you that public comment does make a difference in the regulatory environment, because our agency, we decided to add the contrasting strip on stairs in the right of way because of public comment, and that was the only reason we did it. So, I mean, it's not the only reason, but it's the deciding reason. It's because we got inundated by people saying we need contrasting color on stairs in the right of way. So you guys may be saying to yourself, you know, public comment doesn't really matter, doesn't really do anything. I can attest to the fact that it does make a difference. So I just wanted to say that.
I hope more individuals, well, there are a lot that haven't been part of the meeting thus far, but we need to get word out to all members of the Accessibility Advisory Committee. Some have been missing AAC meetings, and a lot have been missing bus rail subcommittee meetings, but somehow we've got to get more people involved in this. Just like Scott said, letters have consequences. My wife has worked on the Hill. And as a staffer serving a congressperson, she knew what happened when they were inundated with letters on one issue. So, Scott, you bring it to us in terms of a federal agency, but I know that there are other bodies that respond to letters as well. And I urge more members first to do this, but second of all, to be prepared to deal with these fiscal cliff in terms of getting your states and your other jurisdictions to chime in on helping to avoid that, avoid WMATA falling over that fiscal cliff. It is now 5:49, anew, no public.
We do have one member of the public who raised her hand, Amanda Hillman. Amanda, when you start speaking, I will turn the timer on for 3 minutes. I would try to give you a heads up 30 seconds in advance before your 3 minutes end. But as I always say, I don't like to interrupt people. At the end of 3 minutes, you will hear a sound alerting you that your time has ended. So go ahead and make your comments.
Okay, thank you. All right. This is Amanda Hillman, African-American female. And I wanted to, okay, so the survey that you all are speaking of, that was something that was specifically just to the AAC committee members?
No.
All right, so if I wanted to, like you all are suggesting, you know, respond to that,
right?
I should contact Ms. Anu to get the survey so that I can respond. Is that how I should do that?
The link to the agency and the deadline. Is that okay. What you...
Amanda, this is
Anu. Yes, yes.
You can surely contact me. I'll be happy to put the link in the chat if that is convenient for you. But sure, you can surely contact me and I'll be happy to provide it to you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And I think this was a very informative meeting, so I appreciate the information.
Okay. Any other public commenters?
We do not have any other members of the public who are interested in making comments at this time.
Okay, then let me wish people who observe it a happy Hanukkah. We don't, as a BRS committee, meet before January. So to the BRS members, I wish you happy holidays as well. Merry Christmas, and certainly to everyone, a happy 2024. This country is at an edge I can't imagine, but all we can do best is to wish and act as if 2024 will be what we want. So again, happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, and to everyone, a happy new year. Yes.
This is Anu. Before you close the meeting for the day, I just want to make my announcement about public comment. If any member of the public would like to submit their public comments before or after the meeting, they can send it through email at metroaacchair@wmata.com. That's metroaacchair@wmata.com. Or call and leave a message at 202-962-1100. That's 202-962-1100. And that concludes my announcement. Thank you.
Thank you. And Scott, you're still here with us. So again, warm thanks for your presentation, but also for other suggestions you made regarding interaction with federal agencies and your own. I appreciate that. And to all members, I ask, is there a motion to adjourn?
This is Sandy. I move we adjourn.
Second?
Felipe, second.
Hearing no objections, this meeting is hereby adjourned. Again, Happy New Year. Thank you all.
Same to you. Happy holidays.
Yes, happy holiday, everyone.
Happy holidays.